Hello, Lawyer on Air listeners. I'm Jane, producer of Lawyer on Air. Today's episode carries a content warning for sexual harassment. We don't go into detail, but if this is a difficult topic for you, please skip through the section at 31 minutes to 35 minutes of the episode. Thank you. Now, let's get on with the show.
Hi everyone, this is Catherine O'Connell and welcome to Lawyer on Air. If you are looking for inspirational stories about women in law, then this is the podcast for you. Join me and my lawyer ladies as we enjoy a glass of wine after a hard day at work and talk about the world of women in law. It's my passion to share stories of amazing legal ladies who are working as in-house legal counsel, who have law firm roles, who are leading on boards and who are doing law differently. From time to time, I will also invite special guests on the show to share their insights on legal recruiting and tips for getting hired as a successful lawyer in Japan. I hope you will enjoy getting to know these amazing women who I am so proud to share a profession with. I'm glad you're here and I hope you enjoy the show. Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Lawyer on Air podcast. In this episode, I share with you another diverse story of a woman lawyer working in Japan. I'm Catherine, the host of the show, and I'm a lawyer based in Tokyo for 20 years, and I love helping unlock the wisdom of the stories that women lawyers never tell. What I've learned in my career in law so far is do the hard yards. Well, those are the words of Tomo Greer, who is my guest today on the podcast. Tomo is a foreign associate at Tokyo International Law Office. She is half Kiwi and half Japanese, born in Fukuoka, made in New Zealand, and with some added spices added in Bangkok. Tomo is a New Zealand qualified M&A and corporate lawyer based in Tokyo. Beyond the corporate veil, Tomo is passionate as a triathlete and a proud Ironman with several age group wins. Incredibly, she has been ranked fifth amateur female in Japan for 2022. You can check out Tomo's full bio in the show notes. On this episode, Tomo shares how, as a former competitive semi-pro Muay Thai fighter in New Zealand and Thailand, she channeled this sport to drive her mindset out of a toxic situation into a newfound place of clarity in her personal life, and that allowed her to return to the law profession after taking an off-ramp for 1 year. She also shares how sport has been a driver to her mental strength in fighting an identity crisis of two cultures and two nationalities to become the whole person she is today, who is authentically happy and ready to tackle her really great days and really bad days, because that's just how life is and how work goes. Nothing is perfect, and no life in the law has perfectly smooth sailing seas. You'll also hear how Tomo recommends anyone thinking of law as their future that absolutely skills trump passion. Though this is counterintuitive to a lot of books out there in the market, Tomo believes that with a solid skill set in place, you can then take a passion to next level. And that is where it all starts to get very interesting. And Tomo also shares her hot tips on food and travel, her favorite books, and a favorite saying that's all about monkeys. And you'll hear she was able to apply that favorite saying to me in our conversation right at the end. And then we finish with Tomo sharing all she loves about Japan and other fun facts. Let's get into it. Hi, Tomo, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Catherine. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, great. Thank you very much. If we were going to be meeting up in person, Tomo, where would we be? Do you have a favorite wine bar or restaurant or cafe that you like to go to? And what would be your choice off the menu today?
You know, it would really depend on what time of day we're meeting up. If it's, you know, if it's midday, then I think both of us being Kiwi, I would love to go to this Kiwi cafe called Iki Espresso in Kiyosumi Shirakawa. And I think we'd both get a flat white there. But if it was a bit later on the day, actually, rather than a wine bar, I'm a bit of a beer girl. So I would suggest that we meet up at OL, Oslo Brewing in Shibuya. They have some amazing craft beers there and an outdoor, really nice atmosphere. So I would suggest meeting up there.
Wow, that's interesting. I've been to both places. I would definitely.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, I would definitely be having a flat white at Iki, that's for sure. And it's such a lovely place, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing.
And it's doggy friendly. Yeah, it feels like home. There's a particular place in Christchurch where I'm from, in Lyttelton Harbour. There's a cafe there, and it just reminds me of that place. So it does feel like home. And Oslo Brewing, I have been there many, many years ago, so I must go back there and have an ale with you. What do you like there? Don't they have, like, I'm trying to think, berry or fruit flavored beer?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, they do. They change their menu probably once a month, and they love exploring with fruity beers, you know, like passion fruit stuff. Yeah, they're really creative. I love their stuff. And yeah, it's just a really great place.
Passion fruit, wow, sounds great. Let's go there sometime soon. Wow,
yes,
let's do that. And then, so I wanted to start off today by asking you about, you know, way back in the day when you were a child, or perhaps even coming into your young adult years, what kinds of careers were you thinking or dreaming up about?
I think it just, if you asked me at 5, at 6, at 7, at 8, 10, 17, I would have given you different answers at every point. And but I think one consistent theme was that I always imagined myself being more, I'm into sports. That's been my personality and one of my passions for a very long time. And since I was a young age, I did sport and that was my thing. So I actually would have told you that I wanted to be a professional athlete, I think. Yeah.
Great. And you kind of see me doing that, right? And we'll talk about that a bit later, because you certainly have kept up your sports and they're instrumental in all you do. I think it's quite a common thread and seems to be really, really inspirational for you and for others, and going through that, I think, helping you with your well-being and all kinds of ways that you do your work. So let's talk about that a little bit later. But you were born in Japan and I think spent a lot of your formative years in New Zealand. Tell us about those early days then, and things you can maybe remember from New Zealand and Japan, and how those two countries have shaped you into the person that you are now.
I think that's a great question. So I was born in Fukuoka, in suburban Fukuoka, and I grew up with a Kiwi father, a single dad, in suburban Fukuoka back in the 90s when there weren't that many foreigners in Japan, let alone Fukuoka. So it was quite unusual upbringing. I went to a normal state primary school, a shogakko, and had a very Japanese lifestyle at school. But, you know, I felt like I was living a bit of a double life. At school, it was very Japanese. And then I would go home, and my dad had a very strict no Japanese at home policy, because otherwise, when were we ever going to learn English? And my dad, he still lives in Fukuoka. He's lived in Japan for over 30 years, and he still doesn't speak Japanese. But, you know, he's really great. And at home, I just remember so vividly, he would have a strictly like no Japanese TV policy. When you're at home, it's time to learn English. So he would play the BBC over and over again. And I remember as a child, I just hated the BBC so much. And I'd be like, no, let's play Pokemon, you know, like all these Japanese animations they're talking about at school. And my dad would be like, no, it's BBC. And, you know, it's BBC, the 6 o'clock news at BBC, and it's the 7 o'clock news at BBC. But I look back and I'm so grateful for my dad for raising me bilingual. That has been one of my, you know, biggest assets, and it's been really useful in my career. And then I moved to New Zealand when I was 11 years old. I'd never had an English education, so it was really tough. And I think one of the toughest things was that, you know, when I was living in Japan, I was treated like a foreigner. The kids at school would call me gaijin, which means, you know, in Japanese, it means outsider, foreigner. So no matter how hard I tried to kind of fit in and be Japanese, I knew that I would never really fully be Japanese. I think things are slowly starting to change in Japan. There's more foreigners. There's a lot more diversity coming into the country. But, you know, that wasn't really the case when I was growing up, especially, you know, it's not a metropolitan, cosmopolitan city like Tokyo, Fukuoka. Suburban Fukuoka was a lot different. So I had an identity crisis from a very young age. You know, I always felt like I felt foreign. And then when I moved to New Zealand, it was the complete opposite. There I was, you know, Asian, not even Japanese. I think, you know, it was still, I think, again, things are starting to change now. But at that time, you know, people were like, okay, you're Asian. And I had a bit of an accent at that point as well. I know now I sound 100% Kiwi and I can't shake it off. But initially when I moved, I wasn't really good at English and I spoke with a heavy accent. So it was really difficult. I think in both countries, I thought there was 100% Japanese and 100% Kiwi. But a lot of my early years, I was made to think that I was, you know, 50% Japanese and 50% Kiwi. So I think, you know, this kind of identity crisis thing, like who am I, where do I belong, was something that I went through from a very, very young age. That was my upbringing. I think it's not uncommon of a lot of people that I've met in Japan who are bicultural, but that definitely shaped who I am today, I think.
How did you work through that then, this identity crisis? I mean, it's I can just hear it from you, what must have happened in both countries, really, your lived experience. How does that lay with you now? How is it sitting with you? Are you feeling like you don't have that anymore? Does it still come up for you?
No, not anymore. I'm really happy and I'm really grateful for those experiences now. I think, you know, it's adversity makes you stronger, and those life experiences kind of give texture and just more meaning to your life. I think my initial way of dealing with it when I was younger was that I would reject the side of me that was being told was foreign. So when I was in Japan, I didn't want to speak English. I didn't want the kids at school to know that I spoke English. I just really wanted to fit in and be Japanese. And later on in my high school years in New Zealand, I didn't want to be thought of as foreign, Asian, Japanese. I, you know, I dyed my hair and I tried to really, really study English very, very hard so I would just fit in with the other kids. And I stopped reading Japanese books and I loved all these typical Japanese things. I listened to J-pop and all those things. And I really rejected that when I was at high school. And it wasn't until later on when I went to university that I thought, God, what a waste. You know, I'm bicultural. I'm blessed enough to be a part of these two very culturally rich, amazing countries. And at one point in my life or another, I'm rejecting, you know, a part of my identity. And so when I was at university, I just kind of went on this journey of, so I went to university in Wellington, Victoria University. And I went on this journey of kind of reconnecting with my Japanese side. You know, let's read more Japanese books. Let's go work. I did an arubaito, like my part-time job at a Japanese izakaya when I was at university. And for the first time, I was speaking Japanese again with Japanese people and working 3 to 4 times a week at this restaurant, eating Japanese food, talking about Japanese culture. And that was really healing for me. You know, I was like, oh, you know, I am Japanese. And now I feel 100% Japanese and 100% Kiwi. And, you know, sometimes that kind of changes where I'm hanging out, what I'm speaking about. I feel more Kiwi or more Japanese, but I don't think anyone can take those identities away from me now.
Oh, it's so lovely to hear you say that, honestly. And, you know, I'd want to say to you, what would you now say to people who might be listening to this, who are debating that between two cultures, two languages, two types of people? I think it's wonderful you've said 50% has now moved to 100% of each of those. Mm. What would you say to people who are listening to this then about that duplicate personality, duplicate culture that you have? What would you tell them?
I think I would tell them, especially in Japan, there's the term hafu when you're talking about mixed race people, which means quite literally you're half of something. I would tell them, no, you're not hafu, you're double. you're double. And you can't let other people dictate your identity. That's something that you kind of have to go on your own journey to figure out who you are. And it's not going to be easy when other people try to put you in boxes. You're this, you're that. And you'll go through days where, you know, like I said before, sometimes you feel more closer to one culture or other culture. And it's also really hard work keeping up those two sides of you, especially language skills. If you live in, when I lived in New Zealand for 5 years, no matter how much I spoke Japanese at my part-time job, that's just not enough to kind of keep a professional level of Japanese. Equally, when I'm, you know, in Japan and speaking Japanese all the time, sometimes English words slip up. It's hard work to keep up both languages and both cultures and keep up to date. But I think it's a blessing.
Yeah. And I think you're exactly right. I try and tell people you're not half, you're double, right? And that is exactly it. And even, you know, I'm half Australian, half Kiwi, actually, with my mum being an Aussie, and I just sometimes say I'm not a half, I'm a double, right? I'm a
hybrid. Yeah, you are.
And I will even rock that as well. And it's cool, right, to be both rather than just be a half of something. I really love that. I'm wondering too, as you're speaking, whether, you know, this real passion that you had for sport also helped you with your identity crisis. Like when you're back in New Zealand and when you're in Japan, was that a way of just getting around it or over it or through what was happening with you in your outer part of your life, shall we say?
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. It was a way of just a healthy way of escapism. You know, for one moment, you don't have any technology, nothing. It's just you sweating it out. Your heart rate's high. You're just thinking about that sport. And I think I've done many different sports throughout my years, but more recently I've been into triathlons. So when you're running, it's just you. It's just you and the clock. And you leave work at the door. You leave whatever personal things going on in your life. And you just run. You just cycle. You swim. It's really, you know, it's like therapy. And I think in my younger years, it was actually I did karate and kickboxing and later on Muay Thai. So very much a martial arts girl. And when you're in the ring, you don't have time to think about that bad day you had. You're just defending yourself. You're trying not to get punched by the other person. And you don't have time to think about the bad stuff. And, you know, when you exercise, you kind of release these endorphins and you come out for an hour having you've forgotten about the bad day you've had or some of the issues that you're facing. You feel a lot better because you've released endorphins, and it's just the best thing for your mental health and physical health. I think even if I'm not having a bad day, it's just the right way to start the day for me. I can't imagine starting the day any other way.
And so when you come out of the sports activity, does it also sometimes not only say reduce or get rid of that problem you had, but have you sometimes found a way out of it, a way forward? So it's still a problem, but you're able to deal with it better having had your exercise through your veins.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I said before that, you know, you think about nothing and you just run, but sometimes those thoughts keep coming in and some days you can't control it. And, you know, I think a lot of people say, I hear in a lot of, you know, autobiographies and podcasts that all these successful people do. And, you know, they say, oh, some of my best thoughts come when I'm walking. I've heard that a lot. And I think
yes, and that's what I was thinking. That's what people say. But and you're saying something a little bit differently. Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, I mean, I think walking and running, it's similar in a way. It's, you know, you've got your heart rate up a bit. You're moving. I think you're stimulated visually if you're outside. There's a lot going on, and I think you just kind of find calm in that. And when you're sitting at your desk, and lawyers, we sit at our desk for very long periods of time in a day, and it's just not inspirational sometimes. You got to get up and move and kind of have a change of environment, change of heart rate, you know, all these things to kind of get a bit of clarity, I think.
How do you become a mobile kind of active person if you've not really been doing that? So if you are, you know, you've been sitting at your desk, or again, through this pandemic, a lot of us stayed at home. Maybe we didn't really get out as much as we could have or should have because we're fixed to our desk. What would be your first sort of few steps for someone who may be just thinking, just love what you're saying and I need a change? What would be the first few things you could do if you're in that situation?
I think you just start small. You set realistic goals, like, okay, I'm going to go walking for 5 minutes a day. And then next week, it's 10 minutes a day. It has to be incremental. It has to be achievable. And you can't hate it. You can't do it because you think, oh, I need to do it. You have to want to do it. And when you set these unrealistic goals so early on, you know, I see a lot of people, you know, okay, I haven't done really any exercise, but I'm going to run a half marathon, and they set out to do 10K training run on in their first week, and they just end up hating it. Their fitness isn't there. You have to make the process enjoyable, and you have to know that things take time, I think, and you just have to be patient, and you have to make it fun. I think that those are the most important things.
Great advice. Wow, that's amazing. And so during all of this time where you're kicking in with your sports and keeping very active, somewhere along the line there, you must be starting to think about lawyer or law, or what am I going to do with my career? So tell me a bit more about that. When did lawyer come up for you as the career, or studying law at least?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that at high school, I wasn't, especially the early years, when people are starting to think, what am I going to study at university? What do I want to get into? I wasn't very good at English still. At 13, 14, I'd just moved from Japan, and my spelling age was awful. But I just kind of had this attitude that, you know, because I'm bad at it, I want to get better at it. And so I think studying law was just this huge challenge. it seemed like, you know, can I really do that? And I think the challenge element kind of attracted me to it. And also my dad, actually, he's had a really big impact on my life. And he always said to me, go, you know, I think law would be great for you. Like, go study it. And he did the exact same thing. He said, if law is one of those degrees that it's a good foundation for whatever you want to do in life. It teaches you to think critically, analytically. It teaches you to write. It's hard, so it's credible, whatever you decide to do afterwards. So if you don't know what you want to do, well, I kind of didn't know what I wanted to do. I wanted to become a professional athlete, but there was some discussions with my dad that were very, very similar. And I think he went down a similar path as me. And he said, you know, you're not going to make money from it. I want you to be independent. When we were younger, he really stressed. He was a single dad taking care of two girls. And he would say to us since we're very young, like, I'm so glad you guys are girls. You know, this century, it's the century of the woman. And I want you girls to be independent in every way, financially, like emotionally, physically, everything. And he said, you know, I get that you want to become an athlete, but I want you to be independent. And at that time, he was pressuring me to kind of go down this academic path. And at the time I resented him, you know, but now it makes sense. I get that he was coming from a really good place. He just wanted us to be independent women. And also he said something about, if you turn that passion that you have for sport into a job, you might end up hating it. And I didn't understand it. I'm like, how could I hate it? I love it. I just want to do it every day. But I get it now, I think. It's important to have those passions that you don't begin to hate because you're doing it over and over again. And I think it's important to have many passions because you can't just do one thing in your life. So anyway, very long story. So I decided to do law. I took his advice and I thought, you're right, if I don't like it, it's given me a good foundation. I'll be critical, analytical. I'll have good writing skills. Let's see how it goes. And then I went to law school and I actually just ended up liking it.
Wow.
Sorry, really long story.
No, but, yeah. It's fantastic. And I've got total goosebumps listening to you. I mean, I want to meet your dad. Obviously, You know, being really thoughtful about his daughters and about your future and knowing that being an independent person and just, you know, doing a career that I love that. It's credible because it's hard. Yes. And you're so right. It's a great foundation for anything you want to do. And he's really set you up well there. I think that's really fantastic. And I it's interesting, isn't it? Because you see a lot of books as well about, oh, you know, do your hobby every day and you'll be happy all your life. It's like, really? You know, turn your passion into a job and you may end up hating it. I think your dad should write a book. That's so true, isn't it? I mean, not every hobby can turn itself into a career that sustains you and that you love for the rest of your life. But look how you've now got this blended career and passion outside of your career, but also interwoven into it. That is your athletic skills that you are doing every single day and also your law. So you've now blended those so well. How interesting. What does your dad say about all that now?
I told you so, I guess.
Thanks, Dad.
No, I think, Catherine, you bring up a really good point. I think a lot of the early on advice that we receive, do what you're passionate about, follow your gut. You know, if I followed my gut, I don't know where I'd be. I didn't have a gut at that point to listen to, you know. That came later on when I drank too much during COVID and ate too much because we were just sitting inside. But it's I don't know. I think maybe this is a very unpopular opinion, but I think you eventually learn to love what you do if you get good at it. And I think when I was having a bit of a career crisis, do I want to, you know, become a lawyer? What do I want to do? Do I want to follow my passion? I read two completely opposite books. One was like, I think it was called Designing Your Life, you know, design your life, do what you're passionate about. And the other one was called, you know, So Good They Can't Ignore You. And I think the heading was, you know, Why Skills Trump Passion and the Quest for the Work You Love. They were complete two different books, two different takes on your career. The first one, as you can imagine, said, found out what you're passionate about and just pursue that. And the second one was really interesting to me. It said, that's actually a really dangerous piece of advice. It's when you gain a particular skill set and you become really good at something and you can take things to the next level and dive deeper. That's when you actually start loving your work. That's when it gets interesting. And that's been, I think, a really interesting piece of advice for me. As kind of unsexy as that sounds, you know, I think everyone just wants to believe, like, do what you're passionate about. That's like, seems like a better piece of advice. But I think, especially with law, when you graduate law school and you your first year, second year associate in a law firm, you're not good at your job to start with. No one is, you know, and you kind of in that first year, you feel a little bit useless. You feel like an imposter. And it's often not fun to do things that you're really, really bad at doing. You might not be really, really bad at it, but you're looking at the more senior lawyers thinking like, God, I'm not creating value like they are. And that's why the first years are so, so hard and many people end up quitting. But it's when you actually stick with it and you gain the skill set and you do something over and over and over again that, you know, you start to see like, oh, I never noticed that. I noticed it on the 10th time that I was doing it, that I could be doing it this way. And then when you keep doing things over and over, you get better at it. You see it from a different perspective. And that I think that's when you master a craft, that's when it starts getting fun. And I think maybe I got that from, I obviously got that from the book that I was reading, but also from sport. You know, you're not good at it from day one. And sometimes when you're really bad at a sport, it's not enjoyable from day one, you know, like, oh, my cardio is not there. I can't run 5K. This is awful. It's when you stick with it and you do the boring drills, you know, you do those repetitive motions over and over again. And when you get to a point where you're good at it, when you finish a race, a really, really hard race, and you finish the crossing, like the line, and maybe at work that might be, you know, you finish a really difficult deal. And that sense of achievement is, I think, pure ecstasy for me, both in sport and in law.
So how have you found what you like now in the law? Because you're at Tokyo International Law, correct?
Yes.
How did you find your way there? And what was it that made you go there in order to pursue this skill set that you'd been building up? What brought you there, and what are you now working on that is just making your life a real joy in the firm? Because I obviously have talked to you before this, and I know that where you are is a place that you really like to be. And so what's brought you there? Tell us more about this building of your skill set and getting to, you know, finding what you like through that mastering of your skill set over and over again.
Yeah, so I think I took a pretty unconventional path to get where I am today. When I graduated university, I knew that I actually wanted to go overseas, and I actually ended up in Thailand for my first job. My first 2.5 years after graduating was spent in Bangkok, Thailand, and that was a really life-changing time. I was working at a Japanese law firm in Bangkok, and it wasn't an easy road to get where I am here today. Back in Thailand and in Bangkok, I was in a very, to start my career off, I was in a very toxic environment. It wasn't easy. One of the reasons why I left there was, I think, the workspace I was working in. There was a small business community of people, I think. And I just want to stress that this is not reflective of, I think, practicing law in Thailand. I have many amazing colleagues and lawyers there that work there, that love it, that do absolutely stimulating work and are surrounded by amazing people. So I just kind of wanted to make that crystal clear. And I also wanted to make it clear it's not typical or anything of Japanese law firms. I think it was very unique to my experience and the particular situation that I found myself in, and the particular people that I've found myself surrounded by. But there was a small business community, I think, lawyers and client side and partners as well. You often work with, you know, financial advisors and banks. There was a community that I think kind of fostered this environment where a lot of client entertaining took place at very inappropriate places, and it just allowed for a lot of bad things to happen. And in my first job, I found myself in the middle of that, and I went through some pretty like traumatic experiences at some of the business dinners that I was taken to as a younger associate. That I think no woman should ever have to go through. And they weren't one-off events. They happened multiple times. And that actually made me end up, I left the law actually for a period of time after that. I was out for a year. And I think the reason why I left was when that happened, I graduated very young. I qualified as a lawyer very young. I was 21. When I started working. So as a 21, 22-year-old girl, and that was the first law experience that I had. That was the first job that I had. I just thought what I was experiencing was common of kind of the law profession and the legal industry. And I thought, I don't want to work in this industry. It's going to be like this everywhere, and I can't hack it. So I ended up leaving for a bit. And what I did in that time was, like you said, I escaped the tough time, the negative emotions I was feeling through sport. And because I was in Thailand and I quit my job and didn't have anywhere to be nowhere to go after that. I didn't have a job lined up. I put myself into a full-time Muay Thai training camp, and I was just a semi-professional Muay Thai athlete for the next few months after I quit my job. And that was just so healing, I think. I had all this like built up anger and resentment and emotions, and I would just get up, I would exercise, I would punch a punching bag for the whole day. I would be in the sunshine eating good food with really amazing people from all around the world that just came there to better themselves, not just, you know, their Muay Thai, like Thai boxing skills, but just to become better people. And it was just the most incredible time. And I found clarity in that time, I think, like I have at all challenging points in my life through sport. And not long after that, I got a message on LinkedIn from this recruiter. He mentioned TKI, so Tokyo International Law Office. And it was quite interesting because I was like, oh, this firm sounds really interesting. And the concept was that the founding members were from all different big four law firms. So in Japan, we have the big four here, and they were from each of them, four of them. And they wanted to do something that was a bit more international, cross-border focused. And they're all very young. They were in their late 30s and early 40s, which I think, you know, for a law firm, for people to be starting their own firms, it's quite a young age. So they had this kind of entrepreneurial mindset and this kind of acute understanding that they needed to do things differently to how traditional big four were doing. And that sounded really interesting to me. But I think with all the bad experiences that I've just gone through as being a woman in the profession, when I saw that it was just four men, I told the recruiter, I was like, no, I think I need female role models. Like, I'm not too sure. It just doesn't seem like there's much diversity. And he came back to me and said, no, that's why they're reaching out to you. That's why they want you. They understand that they need diversity. And, you know, you're young, you're foreign qualified, and you're a woman. That's exactly why they want you. And it will be a big leap of faith joining as the first foreigner and first woman. But, you know, you could be an asset. You could really bring a different perspective. And, you know, I was like, okay, I'm up for the challenge. Let's do it. And throughout the interview process, they were just amazing. They're just really great people. I bonded with them on a personal level. And I think what's important when you start a job is you can really imagine working with those people, because you end up spending a lot more time with those people than your family sometimes when you're busy. So you got to pick the people right. And that's how I ended up at Tokyo International. I haven't looked back, and now the team has, I was the seventh member to join. Now we've got 30 lawyers, I think. A lot of women, a lot of foreigners, and a lot of different ways of working. I have amazing role models, both female, male, Japanese, foreign. And I'm happy now. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's so bold to say to the recruiter, hey, there's four men there. There's a place for me. And then finding out that's exactly what they wanted. I wonder too, during those tough times, you were doing your physical, you were physically getting rid of that toxicity in your body. Did you talk to anyone during that time too? Was your dad around at that stage, or were there other people that you were able to talk to?
Yeah, I think at all points in my life, I've been really blessed with the network of people that I've had, friends, family, but also just kind of trusted advisors that you just connect through, meet through networking events or, you know, at work. Yeah, it was really tough. I think everyone told me different things. People that love me that had the best intention say, you know, you're not happy, like you need to quit. This is toxic. This is unacceptable. Like, we're sorry this is happening to you. You need to quit. And, you know, people that were one level removed from, let's say, like not my closest friends or family would say, you know, this is toxic. You should move to another firm. It's not the industry, which is the problem. And then other people say, maybe try this, try that, you know, go on a sabbatical. But everyone gave me different advice. Like, there was no consistency. It was not coherent at all. You know, I actually wrote down every piece of advice that people gave me during that time. And it's just so varied.
How did you filter it then? I mean, I can just hear people saying, do this, do that. And you've got all these voices going on and they all care about you, obviously, and know you to a certain extent. But how did you filter that out and filter it to what made sense to you?
I think you just have to really sit with your thoughts and kind of ask yourself, like, what do I want to do? I think when people go on holiday, for example, and they say, oh, it'll be really good, you know, to refresh, and they are traveling, they're going seeing things, and that's great. But I don't think that's you're really sitting with your thoughts. I think when you're facing a upcoming, like, difficult decision with your life, career choice, or, you know, something personal decision, you need a holiday, but you don't need a holiday where you're kind of moving around, and you need to really sit down and think, I think. And not many people do that. You need like a day where you just dedicate to, like, all right, I'm going to bang out this life question. And it's a process. You can't figure it out in a day. Rome wasn't built in a day. But you need to really make time to ask yourself some hard questions sometimes, I think.
Excellent. Wonderful. This is really, really very, very interesting. So I'm going to ask you a big question, though, to finish this sentence for me. The most important thing I have learned from my career in law so far is?
Do the hard yards.
Do the hard yards.
Yeah. I think when we graduate university, we've got these kind of rose-tinted glasses, and we think, like, we've done the hard yards and I'm ready to thrive and, you know, be an expert. But there's a lot more hard work coming. And I think someone needs to be quite honest about that. You know, it's only when you do the hard work that you get the rewards. There's no single job that I can think of. This isn't just about law, but there's no magical job where you graduate from university and you're good at from the beginning. You really have to gain a skill set, I think, before you're good at something, before you start enjoying it. And you just have to have this growth mindset. And don't get me wrong, the process is sometimes it's not bad every day. It's not fun every day. It's not bad every day. It's a roller coaster of emotions. And I think you just have to be really ready for that.
So brilliant. And I also love how you picked out before, when you're selecting firms, right, to be imagining working with those people and picking the people. I think that's absolutely the case, because often we choose the brand name or the big thing, right, or the prestige of something, whereas actually you are spending 80%, would it be 80% of your time is with people that you're working with. And so I loved that piece of advice that you had as well, that working with people you're going to be liking and having a bonding with them is really important as well.
Yeah, I can't stress that enough, actually. Like, when you get to a certain level in law firms, they're all, you know, at the top level, and these league table goes out. There's like law firm rankings every year. To be absolutely honest with you, maybe I shouldn't be saying this, there's probably not that much difference between the top 10. It's just what kind of deals they've done in the past year, and one law firm's above the other for this year. But the quality is going to be pretty similar there. The projects that you're going to be on, the quality of those projects, the amazing clients you're going to work with at that top level, it's going to be the same. So you really have to base it on, you know, can you imagine yourself working there? Like, are they good people? Do you think you'll work well in a team with them? We're not robots. We're human. You can't take the human element out of any job, I think. And I'm really happy that during that interview process, and I think it's because I went through such a hard time. I think in my first job, just kind of looking at things just superficially and thinking that seems like a cool thing to do without really asking myself about the people that I would be working with. And the second time round, after having gone through a hard time, I really put emphasis on what kind of people I'm going to be working with. And I think it's the most important advice I can give other people, I think.
Awesome. I love it. Oh gosh, I said awesome. That's so Kiwi. All right. Well, I'm going to go back to sports because I know this is just such an important thing for you. Well, what kinds of things translate from that world of sports into the world of law? I'm thinking like mental strength, agility, dealing with pacing yourself, but there might be some other things that come up for you that you see that correlation between those two things that you've spent your skill sets on, right? Your skill set in law and your skill set in sports and marathons that you are doing. Tell us about that.
So right now I'm into triathlons. I did my first Ironman last year.
Woo!
Which was quite an experience to say the least. Yes. And for those who don't know what an Ironman is, it's a race that has a cutoff time of 16 hours. And in those 16 hours, you have to do a 4-kilometer swim, or it's a 3.8-kilometer swim. You get out of the water, then you do 180 kilometers on the bike, and then you get off the bike and you do a full marathon, which is 42 kilometers.
Oh, my goodness.
And you have to do that in 16 hours. It's quite often called, you know, the hardest race in the world. As you can see, it's really no easy feat. But I was juggling the training for that with work last year, and it was so difficult, but probably one of the most amazing life experiences I've had. So to give you an idea about what kind of training you have to do to cross the finish line, just to cross the finish line, they recommend that you have to be exercising, probably training for 12 to 16 hours a week. So when you work a law job, that is not a 9-to-5. It's, you know, it really depends on projects, I think, but the projects you're doing on at the time, but it's very much a, you know, 9 to sometimes 8, 9, 10, 11 midnight job. So I knew that going into this training that I had more limited time compared with, I think, other people that did, let's say, like a normal 9-to-5, 9-to-6 job. And it just gave me this incredible time management skill that I'm not sure if a lot of my friends will call me organized, but I'm definitely more organized now than I was before I went on this Ironman journey. And I just realized how precious my time was. I had to exercise during the weekday, maybe an hour and a half to 2 hours in the morning before I started work. And then weekends, on Saturdays, my training plan included maybe a 5-hour bicycle ride Saturday morning, getting up early, going to the mountains, and then on Sunday, somewhere between 15 to 20 kilometers running. So that would take me another 2 hours or something on a Sunday. And then you just kind of calculate, okay, how much time do I have in my week and how do I want to spend that? And it just really made me think about how I spend my time. So that's one thing that was, I think, quite beneficial from my Ironman training. But as I touched on very early on, when you asked, you know, what advice do you have for people that want to start getting fitter or start running, you start incremental. I think it's all about, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. I said that before, but it's just a process. And you really have to enjoy and embrace the process for all the ups and downs. And this is so applicable in law as well. You have to enjoy the process. There's going to be some huge ups and there will be huge downs. You're not going to love it every day. And I think that's been true for both with my Ironman journey and my law journey. You don't love it every day, but sometimes you absolutely love it. And that kind of, you're doing it for growth and you're doing it for that kind of like ecstasy feeling at the finish line. Or, you know, when you finish a really crazy M&A deal, you've been working like 12, 16 hours a day, trying to close a deal, trying to get, you know, the signing of the deal. And when it's done, it's just, it's kind of similar to kind of finishing a race almost. You've got this adrenaline flow and then you finish it and it's like, oh, wow. So yeah, it's, I think the skills that I've learned from triathlon, just start slowly. It's all about consistency, increase it, 5%, 10% every week. And then not expecting results to show up immediately. I think that's been a really a key takeaway. I think when we're lawyers, especially quite young, early on, we expect to suddenly, okay, we've done one M&A deal, I'm going to be good at it now. Like, yes, you'll be better than you were before, but you need to do a few more before you actually become the expert. And I think that's a really important lesson that I've learned through law, but also through sport.
You know what? I think you are well placed to be an absolutely awesome mentor for younger people. You may think you're too young to do that, but my advice would be, or my guidance would be, think about doing some mentoring of others who are struggling with some of the things that you've really pulled your way through. There are people who are doing and experiencing that and maybe don't know where to go and who to talk to. And I think you'd be an absolutely wonderful mentor through the struggles that you've had, stepping out of law and coming back into it and finding your place and helping people along that journey. So I'd just leave you with that thought. That might be something to think about if you're not already doing such a thing.
Thank you. That's it's good, great to hear coming from you. I appreciate that.
All right. Well, as we wind down, I did want to finish on a slightly lighter note, which is the final quick fire round of questions, and I hope you're ready for these.
Oh, okay, let's do it.
All right, your favorite Japanese food, and where can I get it in Tokyo? Or outside of Tokyo, if it's from outside of Tokyo.
I'm going to be really basic and say onigiri from the convenience store. That is, oh man, the variety, the cheapness, the accessibility. Like, don't get me wrong, I love fine dining, but onigiri, like I could have one every day.
You are right. And it's so fancy these days. So there's so many lovely ways and options of having onigiri. I'd have to agree with you on that. What's the place then in Japan that you'd most recommend people visit?
I'm going to be very biased here and say Fukuoka, because I am from Fukuoka, and this amazing village called Akizuki, which is where my family is based. It's in the mountains in Fukuoka. It's a small village that used to be a samurai castle town. And that's where my family's based. My dad runs a few Airbnbs there. So if you're stuck on places to go, it looks straight out of a Studio Ghibli, Studio Ghibli film, kind of like Spirited Away, Princess Mononoke. It's just green. It's amazing.
Wow, sounds exciting. Oh, I've got thoughts now of planning a trip there. Wow.
Yes.
So I was going to say, what's the one thing you love about Japan? What comes up for you if I ask you that question?
Oh, mountains, convenience store, people, food, my friends, Don Quixote, izakaya.
Hey, I said one. Things. Hang on a minute. I said one, but that's great.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, all of those things. Do you have a favorite saying in Japanese or in English?
I do. In Japanese, it's called Saru mo ki kara ochiru. And in English, it translates to even monkeys fall from trees.
Yes.
And
what does that mean to you? Obviously, we've got the literal meaning, but what does that mean for you?
I think no one's perfect. Even I see even like professional athletes or even, the partners at my law firm, sometimes you just make small mistakes. Even the best of the best do. So I think when I was younger, I would make one mistake and I would think it was the end of the world, that I'd get worried, like I'm going to lose my job over this one comma that I didn't put in. And I think you just have to remember that even the best of the best mistakes, and don't beat yourself up, just learn from it and get back on that tree.
Absolutely. Get back up on the tree. What is something about you that a lot of people don't know?
I get categorized into these two distinct boxes often, you know, lawyer and then like this person that does all the sports stuff. So those have, I think, been my two labels. But recently I'm trying to be a bit more cultured and I took up salsa dancing with my partner. So I think not many people know that. Yeah.
That's lovely. Wow. Amazing. Thank you so much, Tomo. I don't want to end it. I don't want to end our conversation, but I do need to do that. I really enjoyed you and everything that you spoke about. Some real vulnerable parts there, and also some so inspiring the way you've come through struggles and taken your life further forward. And we can just hear from your voice how happy you are and in a really great place. I think that's absolutely inspiring for people. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today.
Thank you, Catherine. It's been a pleasure for myself as well. And have an amazing day.
Yeah. So for listeners who are interested in connecting or learning more from you, where can they reach out to you, Tomo?
LinkedIn, the firm website, my current firm website.
Great.
Yeah.
Please don't inundate Tomo with all your questions, but she is available and we'll put that in the show notes for you. So if people have been listening to this and are inspired in some way to keep going, keep subscribing, please also share this episode with someone you know who would really appreciate hearing it and be inspired to live a lawyer extraordinaire and be inspired to live a lawyer in
Even monkeys fall from trees, Catherine.
And be inspired to live a lawyer extraordinaire life is what I was trying to say, Tomo. You are so right. And I really just think I'll call it a day there. Thanks so much, everybody. See you on the next episode. Cheers, kanpai, and bye for now. Thank you so much for listening today to this episode of Lawyer on Air. I really hope that you were inspired by the story you heard and that you discovered something new about women in the law. Please subscribe to the show so that you don't miss future episodes. And if you can think of even just one person to share this episode with, that would make my day. I invite you to connect with me to talk more. Jump on over to LinkedIn or Instagram where you can find me, or send me a message via my website contact page. That's all from me today. I look forward to seeing you right here on the next episode of Lawyer on Air. Cheers, kanpai, and bye for now.